Index investing or passive investing has grown more popular with investors. Even Warren Buffett touts the benefits of owning an entire index like the S&P 500 over the long term. An example of an index tracking ETF is BMO's S&P 500 Index ETF. It's the largest ETF in Canada that tracks this well-recognized and popular index. It provides exposure to the returns of the market cap-weighted S&P 500 index at a low cost, the management fee of just 0.08%. This broad market ETF makes for an efficient building block in a portfolio, saving you time and effort while mitigating single stock risk. If you're looking for exposure to the largest and most liquid public companies in the United States, this ETF delivers an easy-to-use solution and instant diversification. Commissions and management fees and expenses all may be associated with investments in exchange-traded funds. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to Looney Hour, episode 130. As always, joined by the three amigos. We've got Keith Dicker, IceCap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM Global. It's been a while.
Yes. PGM. I'm here in the blizzard of April, which is crazy. I'm not sure I'm approved of this Montreal weather. I forgot about all these, but it's there's 30 centimeters of snow outside. So naturally, I'm working from home. I don't think any of my colleagues are going to make it to work today, sensibly. And we're here with low energy Steve. Steve, are you okay?
Yeah, I've been bedridden with the flu for the last 2 days, and man, this is a lot worse than COVID. Let me tell you, I should have got a couple more booster shots. This one's taking me down. So truthfully, I don't think I'm going to make it through the show, but, our listeners will get to enjoy Keith and Rich for probably the back half of the episode. So there you go.
What are we going to talk about? What will we find, Rich? Steve's going to listen to this like tomorrow or whatever it's going to be, like with everyone else.
He's going to say hands, with his head in his hands.
Yeah, he's going to say, what a flop. Or maybe it'll be the best one ever. We'll see.
It's going to be a 3-hour episode.
It's going to be a rant and rave. We'll be all over the shop. We won't have anybody to keep us in line.
I have to go get my tinfoil. Got to make my hat as well.
This is going to be like the lost episode.
Yeah. Guess what I did yesterday? I totally messed with the guy. I had my winter tires taken off, switched off my car. So I messed with, you got 30 centimeters in a blizzard there in Montreal, and we're going to get it now later on this afternoon. You know, it already ricocheted up in Kitsilano and hit the king there. So
I was supposed to get my tires off yesterday.
Do you get winter tires on in Kitsilano?
Just because I wanted to go up to the mountain and ski this year. So I decided to get them for the first time. But I didn't make my appointment, suffice to say. So
I love the guys from Kitsilano. They go to Whistler for one day and it's like a $5,000 round trip expense.
Yeah, $30 beers.
And the witchers. Anyways, Steve, I know you're not well there. Did you want to jump into anything first before you?
Yeah, care of the housing front. Well, it's funny. I actually had, I told you guys this off the air, but I had a chance to meet Mark Miller in person, the immigration minister. So he was in Vancouver and his team invited me out and we sat down for an hour and had a good chat. And
did you have beers or was there like, you know, cocktails and stuff?
No, man, not gonna lie. It was like kind of boring. It was just like a big boardroom with a glass of water and a table that was built for 40 people. And there's four people in the room.
Were you socially distancing?
I didn't.
Should have.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's where I got the flu. Actually, maybe Mark Miller got me.
No.
So, what
did you guys talk about? Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about the conversation.
I mean, honestly, man, I think the outcome on their side was like, listen, we're doing stuff, trying to fix it. There's a lot of interests that are involved. I think they were trying to say to me, hey, listen, like this guy's an influencer. He's got the Looney Hour pod. Let's get him on our team and let's you know, show them that we're working towards a solution. I mean, there's definitely a bit of finger pointing going around the room, you know, private companies, Tim Hortons wanting cheap labor, you know, private colleges fleecing people. So there was a lot of finger pointing.
What about realtors? Do realtors get a job out of it?
Yeah, no, he left the realtors out of it. But anyway, so it was an interesting conversation. You know, we kind of talked. I think these guys are really hoping and needing rates to come down. Truthfully, you know, we had a discussion around immigration levels and, you know, Ben Rabideau's stats, which is taking it from 1.2 million population growth down to 300,000 and what that might do to relieve shelter inflation and CPI. And then I think there's definitely a hope that if they pull through with this, that, you know, the Bank of Canada is gonna be able to cut rates. So that was kind of my takeaway.
Any conversation about, you know, differentiating between the problem and the symptom of a problem. So, for example, it's our view that, you know, that the housing crisis today and population with all this stuff, they're all symptoms of a much bigger problem that's been accumulating, you know, over decades. So what's happening, you know, the government are coming out with, you know, new plans every week or every month to put, you know, more duct tape on a problem without even actually going back and fixing the big problem.
Well, the big problem is all the debt, no?
Correct. Yeah. We're at the end of a 40-year cycle of declining rates, 80-year cycle since Bretton Woods finished, you know, and all the everything that was adapted at Bretton Woods. So it's, you know, I don't know if it can be fixed or not. But it just seems to me like they're always just trying to, and it's not, you know, you mentioned like the, I think you mentioned at the table, you know, they're trying to get someone on the team or anything. To be clear, Looney Hour, we're on no one's team. We're on your team. We're on the team. We're on Team Canada here. We're trying to get everything.
I like, you know, that.
Yeah.
That's like a good slogan. Looney Hour, we're on your team.
I did say that to him. I said, listen, I don't really care what stripes you're wearing. I said, I'm just, you know, here if I can help in any capacity to hopefully, you know, make the country a better place. Great. You know, so maybe Jagmeet will call me next.
Maybe he has the house to buy.
That silence was everyone here waiting for the phone to ring. Yeah. Waiting.
Jagmeet's got a few houses.
My question for you, Steve, I know you're low energy Steve today, so we won't string you along too badly, but my question is, is there like do you feel that they're at least acknowledging that there's been a massive error, or is it just sort of, are they just trying to sort of paper over it? Like, you know what I mean? Correct your position, you must admit that you've made a mistake. So have we got the first step right?
They definitely seem worried about the integrity of the system, right? I mean, it's just, especially because, like, I think for them, right, it's like their young voter base, millennials, are predominantly renters. And these millennials are obviously competing with all these foreign students and temporary workers in the rental market, driving the rents up. So, you know, if you're JT and you got an election and you need that cohort to be supporting you, you know, it is turning anti-immigrant in this country. So,
which is a shame, by the way.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think there was a little bit of responsibility that was admitted, but I think there was also a bunch of finger pointing towards like lobbyists, private corporations. But I mean, my view is at the end of the day, it's like, Rich, you know, like at the end of the day, if you're the prime minister, let's call you the CEO of a public company, like at the end of the day, the buck stops with you, right? You're at the top. Like, it's your responsibility. Even though it might not have been you that screwed up, you know, it might have been your chief marketing officer that ran a bad advertisement at Bud Light, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You hired that person and you're the one that's running and operating the company. So that's kind of how I look at it, but.
You know,
fair enough.
I had two conversations over the last week. I call them a younger generation. So Gen Z, is that, you know, someone in their late 20s, early 30s, sort of in that range?
Yep, is that's Gen Z.
What is the Z for?
I don't know. I should know that, but I'm going to look it up sheepishly. Carry on.
Let us know. Send us an email. But this one gentleman, foreign student, he's studying, geez, a heavy degree. chemistry, science kind of stuff. Like, it's not slacking. And he's working two different jobs, which add up to almost a full-time job during the week. So this guy is going full on. And he said, I'm just barely getting by. You know, he's not living any lifestyle that's of value, really, or that anyone would want to have. And he's working his butt off, you know, with studies and everything. And then I was chatting with another person, and call them a local kid if you want to. And same thing, you know, they're studying full time. And the concept of owning a home or just trying to enjoy life the way that you think you'd want to enjoy it, the hope is gone. So they, as you said, see, like it's government. Everyone's looking at government now for a leader, looking for direction. They need hope. And the hope isn't throw money at, you know, for this Band-Aid on there, another one over there. It's actually coming back to, hey, what's the real problem? You know, the symptoms are a result of that. And hey, we got some pain ahead of us, but let's fix this so we can go forward. But no one can do that. Nobody is so willing to do it. Because then you're admitting you're wrong, right? And it's one thing for the corporate sector to do this. You referenced the Bud Light stuff, right? I mean, everyone knows that marketing campaign that didn't work out very well. You know, they ripped that Band-Aid off, said we made a mistake and we're going forward. But I sort of get the impression right now with governments, it doesn't matter if it's Canadian or British or American, you know, you're always just trying to, you know, you never admit that something was done poorly. And you just got to make it through to the next week or the next day and hope the polls improve.
Yeah. Well, it's budget. I think their budget announcement's coming up in a couple of weeks, Keith. So they're, if you've noticed in the news, they've been dropping all these goodies. It seems like a new spending bill is being announced on a daily basis right now. So if you're looking at the Canada picture, particularly on housing, they announced a $6 billion spending that would be given to basically provincial governments to do infrastructure upgrades for housing. So, you know, the big issue with housing right now is, like, for example, the BC government says, oh, you know, we're going to make it mandatory that you have to allow fourplexes on every single family lot. The issue with that is it's going to put massive strain on your infrastructure, which is your city sewer, your water system, your sewage system. And so that's going to cost, you know, tons, like millions and millions and billions, billions of dollars to upgrade. And so the concern, of course, was like, well, we're going to have to pass that through to the developer builders, and that could make these projects unfeasible.
Don't forget the rain. It's going to rain every now and then too, Steve.
Yeah, the rain tax.
Yeah.
But anyways, long story short is the BC government, or sorry, the federal government saying we're going to give $6 billion to these provinces that get on board with making fourplex right of way. So they're saying, because if you follow the news, it was Doug Ford came out and says, listen, like, we're not going to allow fourplexes across the entire province. Like, he shut that down. So he hasn't followed the BC government's footsteps. So the Trudeau government says, well, listen, if you want money, if you want $1 billion to upgrade your sewer and water treatment, et cetera, you're going to have to sign off on that. And then we'll sign off on the fourplex and we'll give you the money. So I'll give them a hat tip. I think it's smart policy, the $6 billion. I mean, obviously, you know, money doesn't grow from trees, but I do think from a housing perspective, if you're trying to get more housing built, more density, this was definitely much needed. They also announced $15 billion of additional CMHC construction financing. So the only reason and the only way that rental housing is getting built today in this country is through CMHC, because the loans are basically subsidized. So they're giving really cheap loans to developers to go and construct new rental buildings. And you can basically get a 50-year amortization on completion to then run and operate the building. So it allows these projects to sort of pencil. So they've given $6 billion there, $15 billion to CMHC to continue funding more of these loans. I do think this is good policy. I think the unfortunate reality is, you know, I got in a fight on Twitter with this former Trudeau economic advisor there, is that, you know, the guy said 8.5 years. So this is great policy, but, you know, I think it's too late.
Well, it's too late for his short-term political career. It's not necessarily too late for Canada, which hopefully will remain a going concern. But I agree with you. It's going to take a while for this to feel. I mean, how long does it take to put up a building? How long does it take to put 200 buildings?
Yeah. So the fourplex stuff, for example, like best case scenario in BC is like best case scenarios. You might have a project or two or three or whatever in the ground starting in September. And then it's another 12 months for construction, right? So like that brings you right into your election. So like you'll probably start to see the first of your fourplexes being finished in BC as the federal election's coming due. So like I said, I think it's too late, but finally some better policy.
And any discussion about if they're doing that, anything for, you know, healthcare, which no one has ever been able, you know, to resolve or improve. Education, is it still not? I think it was Rich mentioned earlier in the episode. You need this balanced approach. The reason why we have this stress in our society today, you know, it's housing, healthcare, education, infrastructure. You know, the population growth just put everything off sides, and a result of that, of course, you know, was the housing problem. So now we're treating a symptom of the population growth, which is still, you know, the other symptom is healthcare and you name it. I don't know, guys, you know, I know, I, you know, we tend to look at risk all the time. And we figure that if, you know, if you focus on risk and you're able to anticipate what it's going to look like and feel like, then you'll know how capital will move and things like that. You know, and again, that's from an investment perspective. But right now, what I'm seeing from these policy moves, it's, you know, put money here, we'll fix that. But you need a complete plan. And I don't think the runway is long enough, because for that all that to work, you need the economy to stay strong. And I think we are headed for a recession here. So I think a year from now, it's going to be another one of, what, you've only built 4 houses in the last 12 months? I see another note here. It says Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, it's creating a $1.5 billion program to help Canadian nonprofit organizations buy affordable apartment buildings to keep the rents down.
I can't keep track. I mean, like I said, he's dropping.
There's a lot of stuff here. So, Rich, run this through. Like, you're going to spend $1.5 billion to buy a property.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm the property owner, and I know you're coming along.
You're just going to raise the price because the person's a price taker and that person's not in the business of buying and selling homes.
Of course.
It's very, sorry. Is that where you were going? Sorry. It seemed very, very straightforward to me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're doing it for nonprofit organizations where you already have a culture of people not involved in this, you know, running a profit.
And there's
loss.
No skin in the game. That's I think, what was it? Nazim Taleb wrote a brilliant book. We don't recommend enough books on we actually do read from time to time here at the Looney Hour. And Nazim Taleb's book, Skin in the Game, is a brilliant, brilliant book that explains why you sort of have all these mismatches between incentives and results. Because often these people have no skin in the game. Or they get paid bonuses when, let's say, the results are less than stellar. Then why would you change your behavior, etc.? And if you show me an incentive and I'll show you a result. And exactly right, Keith. I think these people are not only are they not necessarily trained to maximize, you know, the supply or let's say the rentership or lower these costs of housing, etc. There are no incentives for them to improve. So I don't see that being like an effective use of funds.
Like, I'm sure you guys are going to get into it when I sign off here shortly, but just the impact on, you know, this continued massive deficit spending. Obviously, bond yields are pushing back up again, not only in the US, but in Canada as well. So, like I said, I do kind of wonder the path that we're on, particularly for interest rates. But I got one last thing on the housing front. Vancouver home sales for March, where those have been kind of playing along at home, we're 28% below the 20-year average for March. So March home sales in Greater Vancouver were 28% below the 20-year average.
Yikes.
So still really slow.
Is that units or average price?
Units. So number of units sold was 28% below the long-term 20-year average.
What about inventory?
Thank God Thank God you got the loony hour.
New listings are about, I think, 12% below the long-term 20-year average. So, like, it's still a picture of basically, like, there's not a lot of people selling. There's not a lot of inventory still in the market. If you have a decent entry-level house, it's still going in multiple offers. But, like, the actual turnover, the volume is still really weak. And so I guess for the average homeowner, it probably doesn't mean a whole lot. I mean, I can tell you what it means for those in the industry is obviously just like a little less volume, right? If you're a mortgage broker, if you're a realtor, if you're a developer, like it's just, there's not a lot of volume. So, you know, incomes are getting hit.
One more question for you, Steve. What is there,
50, 60,000 realtors in Toronto? I don't think their numbers are a whole lot better than ours, but I don't have the figure handy.
It's kind of related to what I just want to ask you. Like, so if you're a realtor in, say, the Vancouver city area, proper area, like how, and you don't have a lot of transactions taking place, like how long you go before you just, you know, you drop out of the industry?
I think people will stretch it for as long as possible. They might pick up second jobs and stuff, but I'll say this. I haven't heard of like a ton of people like leaving the industry. I just think it's just like, they're getting killed, right? It's just like, oh, you know, done. Guys have gone from doing 10 deals a year to three. And it's like, well, how long can you last on three deals a year? I mean, that's, you may as well work at McDonald's.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I mean, I'm looking at the Ontario employment, real estate, rental and leasing. In Ontario, there's 121,000 or 122,000 people as of January 2024. And that number's basically been flat for a year. But isn't starting, and you could argue, you know, may start rolling over, hasn't, mind you, that data is often sort of a little bit lagging. And then for Alberta, it's definitely starting to come down. And British Columbia, I can't seem to find it. So, but yeah, so there you go.
Well, yeah, I think this is where I leave you guys.
Yeah. Aw.
There she was, Steve.
She was gone. I'm going to go back to bed.
Steve, that's pretty good. I think, you know, the history of the loony hour, I know I missed one episode. I think Rich missed one. You know, you're missing,
this is my first one, and I'm like half
10% to one. Rich and I were just going to tell a joke for a few minutes, then we're shutting it down. Then we're done.
No, there's so much stuff going on.
Yeah, I know there are.
Yeah, there's lots in the markets, and I'll let you guys banter about markets. You're smarter than I am, so love you. And I guess I'll see you next week.
All right. Okay. Cheers.
Bye, Steve. Okay, Rich.
Okay. What do we do?
Let's do our Steve Sureski impersonation. I'll go first.
Okay. All right.
Vancouver housing sales. Houses are up. Okay, but seriously, what do you... let's go through some market stuff. We also have the... you know, we had the last week, we mentioned at the very end of the episode, because we had Ben Rabideau on last week. It was a great conversation. But prior to the interview with Ben, we had the Bank of Canada, basically Carolyn Rogers productivity speech.
Right.
So maybe we can touch on that a little bit, and then we can move along to a couple of the other big items that have been, you know, coming across our screen. Does that sound fine with you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so should I go over the speech? I mean, so the key thing was that she gave a speech in Halifax. So central bankers will go from, they do this in the US, they do this in France and wherever other major developed countries and emerging market countries. And they'll go basically and meet with business leaders, union leaders, politicians or whatever. So this is not unusual to see Carolyn Rogers on sort of a road show to discuss specific topics. You know, they might do energy in Texas and, you know, tech in Silicon Valley or whatever. So anyway, so she went to Halifax to give the speech. And the title of the speech, if you guys remember, was "Time to Break the Glass: Fixing Canada's Productivity Problem." And that's quite the strongly worded title. I mean, again, just like auditors for the Canadian government are usually quite demure in their language and very careful, central bankers are as well. And, you know, I won't go over the whole speech, although I'd love for people to watch it or read it. But I think that there's a couple of things that I think are really important that I wanted to highlight. And we touched on it last week, but I'll just sort of flesh that out. Is that all right, Keith? Just quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe like they make it very simple here first. Like as you mentioned, sure. I find over the last year and a half, starting with the Fed, that they've started to become more critical, if that's the word. Or isn't it funny? Critical seems to be negative.
No, a critique.
If you're critiquing someone, it's positive, right? So, you know, for anyone you want your feelings heard, you're just being critiqued. But there's been a lot of critiquing going on by central banks towards the government side that's doing the fiscal spending. So all the borrowing and taxing and spending, all that stuff, you know, which is the Treasury Department for the Americans and, you know, the FinMin up here. So for Bank of Canada to actually put, you know, time to break the glass and, you know, what's the analogy for that, Rich? What does that mean?
Emergency. In case of emergency, break glass.
Yeah, so you're running around a big room, which is Canada, and all of a sudden, like I did, there's a disaster somewhere, and you need, what are we breaking for the alarm or to get the axe out in this case? What is it?
The axe. We're Canadians. Of course we have an axe.
Yeah, I think you go with the axe, right? Yeah. You want with the blade on both sides to make it very dramatic. But again, for a central banker to come up with that title and then to launch into what it really means, you know, they're not saying break the glass because, you know, we messed up with monetary policy because, you know, they're not going to admit that, of course. But it is clearly, though, focused on the spending and borrowing. Because as we've mentioned before, the challenge we've had in Canada, and same with the Americans as well, and the Europeans, especially the Japanese, is that all the benefits that the central banks wanted to achieve by raising interest rates, a lot of it was offset by the government spending, right? Coming out of Ottawa.
But it wasn't just that. It wasn't just the deficit. So let me get into it.
So you get that conversation going on, and then it sort of then leaked into the, you know, the number one theme that we've been talking about for quite some time, because anyone can borrow and spend money, right? And you can do stupid borrowing and stupid spending. And at the end of the day, you know, you went to Vegas or something for a trip, right? That's stupid. Like, that's not going to be productive. So I think what this speech went into was, hey, Canada's productivity has been declining. And this is where you can jump in. It's because even though we borrow a lot over the years, like, it hasn't produced anything for us. Is that fair to say?
So I think the first thing to do, let's give Canadian Bank of Canada some credit. I think they deserve a lot of credit. Let's just give them some credit. I think so Canada's been having a productivity crisis, and I want to highlight some points that she mentioned, but I don't want people to think that the BOC just woke up to this yesterday. If you just Google BOC and productivity, you'll find numerous papers on the differences in Canada, the failures, the potential successes and problems. So this idea that she just woke up yesterday and listened to the Looney Hour and thought it was a good idea to go to Halifax and give a speech, that's wrong. So, there's three factors of productivity, and she talks about this, which is labor, capital intensity, labor composition, and multi-factor productivity, sort of how efficiently capital and labor are used. Capital intensity is just how are you using your capital properly. Labor intensity is, are your individuals productive or not? And you actually highlighted a point she made, which is not to say that people aren't working hard or people don't care or they should work harder. It's that are they being necessarily efficient with the time that they're being used? And the reason productivity is such an important part at this juncture is because we know Canada's per capita GDP has basically flat on 8 years. It's lagged behind the US, she articulates that. But also she says productivity is a way to inoculate the economy against inflation. And then I quote, an economy with low productivity can grow only so quickly before inflation sets in. So that's something that, so that's why I think that they're really sort of talking about. The things that I thought, the takeaways I thought just really quickly were one was a shot across the bow against the anti-energy piece that our government insists on doing. So she says Canada is known for some high value industries such as, and the first one she lists, energy and aerospace, which is also true. And so I thought that was really interesting. She touches on immigration, said in January, working age population grew by 125,000 people. That's the fastest single month of workforce growth on record. And then here's the rub. Too often new Canadians are working in jobs that don't take advantage of the skills they already possess. They are stuck in low wage, low productivity jobs, which is something Steve mentioned when with his conversation to Mark Miller and the lobby groups who sort of benefit, and sort of the knock-on effects for people, mostly younger people, who get screwed because if you increase supply and demand stays the same, what happens to price? Price falls. But the key thing, which I think we've talked about, I think I had to mention, she said, but if I had, and this is a quote, but if I had to pick the biggest concern in this area, I'd say it's competition. So Keith, you'll be happy to know that at least the Bank of Canada knows we're getting screwed by all kinds of industries. So competition drives companies to be more productive by innovating and finding ways to be more efficient. And then she goes on to list, the ones that we know that there aren't, that we know that there's no competition. But the other way competition is important is because if you don't have competition, you're less incentivized to invest in capital and invest in your labor, capital by the next machine, the newest technology, and labor by training, et cetera. And so that's what we have in Canada. We have oligopolies, which we're all familiar with. They have their higher margin necessarily than other sort of similar companies. We know that from telecom business and et cetera. And these companies, and then I quote, if firms have high profits, high margins, and limited competition, they may not feel as much pressure to invest. And so, and then I'm not going to read the whole speech, although I'd love to. That's it, Keith. I mean, that's in the nutshell. You know, it's the competition. It's so the regulation, she talks about that. It's the job mismatch, she talks about that. And I think that the fact that they're highlighting that, as you've articulated many times, is a direct kind of repudiation of what's been going on from the government perspective.
That was a pretty good readout, actually. You said you're not going to read it at all, but I think you...
I really want to, but I won't.
yeah. And, for everyone who's listening, to us here right now, some conversations we have are, Steve's views are not that important sometimes, right? But we love you, Steve. You come back, of course. But this... speech, and I think we haven't talked about it, Rich. I think you would agree, though. I think it was probably one of the most important speeches that have come out of the Bank of Canada in recent years.
Yes, for sure.
So now you have this, right? It's clearly saying to Canada as well as our governments, because it's not just Ottawa, it is on the provincial side as well. So hey, we have the problems we have today, what's perceived to be a problem is a symptom of a bigger problem,
right?
Is what we, it's been unproductive borrowing and all that stuff. The question here, of course, and we don't know the answer, I think I know the answer, but will there be a policy response, based on this, speech that came out? So what are your thoughts on what Ottawa heard from this, or if anything, or is it just, already markets have forgotten about it, everyone, walking around the street, most people haven't even heard it, of course.
Yeah,
but it was incredibly important to have it, to hear it, to read it. And next you want to see, okay, what is the response? So why don't we go through maybe what the fiscal response could be and what the monetary response could be. Let's do the monetary side first.
For me, I think it's, I've said this for a long time, I think it's about keeping real interest rates positive. And people say, how is real interest rates related to productivity? Well, I'll give you the opposite example. If your real interest rates are negative, you can basically borrow for free, right? You're getting, in effect, when you account for inflation, you are getting effectively subsidized borrowing. And what that engenders and encourages is basically levering up your assets. And that's what we've seen. I've said this at work, although people at work often disagree with me, which is fair enough. But show me a negative, I'll show you a negative real interest rates, and you show me a real estate bubble. Negative real interest rates in Ireland and Spain were followed by negative real interest rates in Germany. Same thing sort of happened in the US, is a bit different, but in Canada, you get housing bubbles. And why? Because people can lever up an existing asset and generate enormous amounts of money because effectively the price of money is it's mispriced because it's negative in real terms. And that has driven a huge amount of cash flow and capital into housing, which, sorry, Steve, is not that productive, or certainly not as productive as, let's say, a semiconductor manufacturer or a pipeline or even a hospital or whatever. And so for me, that's one of those That's one of the big sort of dislocations we've had, and why I think that the Central Bank of Canada, despite the fact that we're having balance sheet recession, despite the fact that we have weak growth, will be very, very reluctant to go back to negative real interest rates.
Yeah, it's, you know, and, you know, a lot of people now, you know, they're thinking hard about this, what you just said, and people who want to own a home, well, they're planning to buy a home, they're saying, Matt, Rich is full of shit. Like, I don't care about productivity, real rates or nominal rates. You know, I just want to buy a home and everything. And that, you know, most times for an economy, for society, if everyone is left to maximize their own utility, is that the correct phrase to yeah. use here? Yeah. Then by default, by an aggregate level, you know, we will secede as an economy, as a society, and so forth. But because we've had policymakers not force, but, you know, strongly urge people to go in one direction over another, and then it's been multiply, you know, year after year, and then like a decade of free money, for example, and in this, that's how we've arrived at this distorted place. Another example with monetary policy, it's you know, they're not only are central banks focusing on this, but so are the commercial banks and seeing how they can lend more to green companies as opposed to non-green companies.
Yeah.
And again, it reduces productivity, you know, it reduces the efficiency and the return that the economy is going to get as a whole. So I love these conversations because I'm excited because I think we are headed for this eventual moment, and whether, you know, it starts tomorrow afternoon or it's next year or whatever, but our system, our economic and social system and geopolitical system, everything is colliding here at the same time.
Yeah.
And it has to happen. It just so happened that everything's been synchronized. It's happening for the Canadians, you know, the Yanks, the Brits, you know, the Europeans and so forth. And it's just this cleansing that we're going to get. So if anyone is unhappy now because they haven't had a chance to buy their home or they weren't able to buy, you know, whatever the Magnificent Seven stocks were and things like that, you know, just be patient because things are going to change here coming up.
There's two more quickly just before. I know we're going to switch gears, but there's two more things that I wanted to mention that might take more time, I think, than we've all hoped. And one is that she mentioned, which I was surprised that she mentioned it, but I think it was a fair criticism of Canada. One reason she said that we have sort of lack of productivity is culture. And I think that that's fair enough. I think that's, again, a symptom rather than a cause, but it's a fair enough point. And, you know, in Canada, over the last 20 years, the way you get rich really is land and lineage. So land, which is, you know, levering up of a housing bubble because real interest rates were kept far too low, and lineage, which is you get handouts from your parents and then you plunk that into land. The other way of, you know, making wealth rather than getting rich, that's a bit crass, but generating wealth is through industry. And I think that the culture of risk taking and building and trying to generate wealth through industry, it just does not permeate the 49th parallel. You know, it seems like, you know, when you go down the United States, it's about building new companies and sort of solving problems and being richly rewarded for that sort of risk that you're taking. Here, it just isn't the same. So I doubt the culture piece will change quickly. But I think, you know, I'm an optimist. I think it eventually will. Hopefully all these immigrants that are coming to Canada can shake things up. And the other piece. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So with culture, I love reading about and trying to appreciate and understand. So you have culture for a country from a national level, regional level. You have corporate culture.
Yes,
so anyone here, anyone who works for the man, you know, as they say, you know, you go for a coffee or a smoke, whatever they do these days. You know, it's you talk about the company, right? And that's culture. It's incredibly hard to change culture, no matter where it is in the world, like government level, you know, regional, from a company perspective. Small companies have their own culture as well. You know, it is what it is. And what's the great thing, though, is that you may not be able to describe it, but you know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay? But the great thing is you don't need to have a dramatic change in culture to make a difference. And what's happened over the last number of years in Canada is that the culture in Canada for risk-taking or penalizing risk-takers and rewarding non-risk-takers, it's tilted. So I think now in Canada, we might have the highest percentage of government workers relative to the workforce in what, decades or history? Where are we?
Yeah, no, it's like since the 90s. It's still below a few other countries, but it's grown because it's significantly.
Yeah, I think so what are we now? Are we over 50%? Like 52?
No. It's not that high. It's not that high. It's higher than it's been in 30 years, but it's not 50% at all. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, so with it. So, I mean, a lot of people right now across the country, maybe you're doing your taxes or you have someone else doing your taxes for you, right? And the biggest crime in Canada, I'm sure it's the same for the Americans, everyone else, you have people who cannot do their taxes. And what I mean by that is not because they're not smart enough or, you know, they don't sit down and try to understand it. Once your tax system becomes too complicated that only specialized people can do it. For example, it's a crime for a senior in Canada to have to go to the H&R Block and pay $50 or $400 because maybe they had, you know, a whole bunch of T5s generated or something like that, you know, to have their tax return completed. So again, it's back to this cultural setup that we have up here, and that these things can change. But it's, again, I go back to, hey, it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
Peter, that's not rich. I know I had trouble snapping.
It didn't.
It's still not coming through.
No, it's all right. These microphones are too good.
But it takes a while for it to happen. But once you do, then you realize. And this goes back to the whole productivity speech, you know. And it's not that, hey, you know, you're not working hard enough. You just happen to be in a position that no matter how hard you work, you know, you're not really improving the world in any way. And that's where, you know, the tax system has to change and the reward system. So if you're rewarded for taking risk, and I don't mean market risk, I mean, you're going to start up a small business, you know, you're going to maybe develop a patent for something, you're going to improve the efficiency for collecting rainwater or, you know, whatever's going to be here. But you get rewarded for doing that, and then that encourages more risk-taking. That's why America is so great as an economy, because the culture is there for that. Whereas in Canada, we have all these monopolies or oligopolies going on. And as you mentioned, you know, you have nice margins, and hey, do you want to spend that on, you know, more investment when you don't have to?
No, maybe not. The competition piece, you know, maybe we should move on, but like the competition piece to me really is what she harped on. And one of the charts that we'll share is the fact that, you know, when you have high profits and high margins and limited competition, you're reluctant to invest because you don't need to. And as a function of that, you know, our private non-residential gross fixed capital formation, which means basically that's a fancy way of saying investment or CapEx, is basically has not risen in 8 years and is down 20% or whatever, 30% from the peak in 2015. And, you know, that I mean, without sort of CapEx, without a change in culture, without sort of unlocking the competition, you know, I think we're going to continue to have this productivity puzzle. On the optimistic side, when you have central banks that are articulating it and when you have a crisis, I think that's one of the inflection points. But anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't we next, do you want to jump over to what's been happening with central banks over the last week?
Sure.
Oh, by the way, we have a Twinkie bet for next week.
Uh-oh. What is it?
Steve already gave me his response before. So
okay,
we have
go
Steve's
for it.
Locked in. What but Bank that? Of Canada Day is next
week.
Oh,
yeah. April something.
Yeah, April the 10th, which I assume it's a Wednesday. What are you thinking? So right now we're at 5%. I don't think they'll cut. What's your diffusion index telling you, Rich?
My diffusion index is telling me that they're not going to cut. And what is it, 15%, I think, for April 10th is the probability? I'm looking at it now. Anyway. But yeah, no, I don't think they'll cut. I think that they'll continue to say what we've seen. I think that if there is a press conference, I'm not sure there's a press conference, but if there is one, all the questions will be related about when they're going to cut, because everybody seems to have variable rate mortgages in the press corps. And I think that they'll continue to push back for the number of various reasons we have, which is the breadth of inflation, And you know, housing accommodation, rent, and shelter that are still way, way, way high, even though core X mortgages is continuing to fall.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I don't think they will have any move next week. I mean, it's easy for them to demonstrate, hey, the data's coming out, you know, and they also had the survey, the private sector survey. I think that came out today as well. You know, no one's, you see the irony here? The Bank of Canada broke the glass, but all the other data that's coming out and, you know, the private sector survey from the Bank of Canada, no one else is breaking the glass. I just find that, you know, sort of interesting. But, you know, they don't have a reason to cut rates next week unless, you know, something crazy happens. Steve thinks they're going to cut by 25 basis points. We have Steve down for a possible Twinkie.
But there has been another central bank that cut, which is the SNB, the Swiss National Bank. They cut. And I can't believe we haven't talked about this. Did we talk about the Bank of Japan raising rates after 17 years? So there's some movements going. You know, you've always mentioned that the world cycle is synchronized. I think we're starting to see that in some ways fray at the edges.
Yeah, well, I think you have to exclude the Japanese thing. They went from minus 0.1 to zero.
They raised.
Yeah,
but the Swiss. So some people might not know, the Swiss franc is one of the strongest performing currencies, let's say, over the last, I don't know, 18, 24 months. It's at an all-time high relative to the euro. The Swiss economy is very much an export-oriented economy. I think its current account balance is something like 8 or 9%, so very, very strong. And it's a safe haven country because it doesn't mess around on the fiscal side, it doesn't mess around on the monetary policy side. And so they're cutting because inflation's low and I guess they want to get back into the currency wars. But so maybe that's just a small little tidbit. But
yeah, and that's where we're going now. Everyone is now tilted to, hey, the next, even the Europeans this morning, the ECB. Yeah. Hey, we're getting closer to cutting. But of course, you know, this is putting this incredible amount of stress in the currency world because the Americans and the American data is saying, we ain't going to cut. Yeah. We don't need to cut. All this entire move about the Fed cutting interest rates, it's because, you know, we have this very short-term memory. You know, we went from, you know, 3 down to 0. We kept it 0 forever and then up to 5, and I think 5.25, right, the Yanks went to. And now they believe, hey, we got to go back down to, you know, the normalized rate again. But the problem that's happening now in the currency world is that if you're signaling that you're going to cut, and meanwhile, the Americans, we're going to go through their data specifically here, what they might or when they might do something. If they're not cutting, you know, it's going to create these enormous distortions, you know, for your local. So, for example, let's just say the Canadians do cut next week and Steve is right. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the Canadian dollar is selling off and, you know, inflation will spike higher again and stuff like that. So, we just cannot stress enough the importance of what the Americans do relative to the rest of the world. Do you want to jump into the American story?
Before we get to that, remember when we got emails about how the US dollar was going to stop being the reserve currency of the world? And I wrote this very long-winded email and how I gave a rant on the, it was probably one of the earlier days in the Looney Hour. I just like to remind everybody sort of that, because it's funny how that's totally sort of fallen away from the Twitter zeitgeist. But anyway, yeah, let's talk about the sort of the data, Keith. Let's go for it.
Yeah, again, the American, it's a different, you know, I happen to believe that, you know, the US dollar will eventually have its crisis moment, but they'll be the last one to do so.
Yeah.
So like on that path that we're going down, or journey, you know, not Aerosmith, you know, journey, it's, you know, you're going to have the emerging markets and the Europeans and the Brits and Canadians and all that. And then the last one is the dollar. So first of all, let's just stick with Canada first. I'm looking at the Bloomberg WIRP screen. Yeah, so we're on the same page here. And so right now for the Canadians, right now markets are saying we might have a rate cut in June.
Yeah.
It's likely we'll definitely have our first cut by July. And then by December, we'll be a total of 75 basis points lower. So, you know, we'll be at 4.25. And so 325 basis point cuts. That's what the market is saying right now. Remind everyone, back in November and December, the market was pricing in 125.
Yeah. And 150 for the US.
Yeah, I think we're around that range. Correct. So remember, at the end of the year, markets were saying soft landing, rate cuts, you know, everything is awesome. To all of a sudden, January, February, March is still a soft landing. Half the number of rate cuts. Still don't need to worry about anything. But you see where we're trending. So I think we are getting closer and closer to, you know, we have this reckoning. But the big one that everyone has to look at, you know, you can't be a serious, you know, podcaster without understanding what the Americans are doing with monetary policy. It's funny. I think someone emailed us recently, or I think he tweeted, you know, he said, honey, the Looney Hour interest rate forecasting podcast is on again. And you can picture her running across the house. You know, you can't wait to listen. But for the Americans, remember, they have meetings in May, June, July, and September, and then November. Reason I mentioned this is because the November election for the Americans is coming up, which is going to be a shit show, by the way. There's going to be so much, going to be a lot of delicious stuff.
I think there's been too much. We'll talk about this as we get closer. Yeah, yeah. I think emphasis on it. I think it might be a little bit of a damp squib, but carry on.
No, it will not be a damp squid. It's going to be highly entertaining. Especially when Obama becomes president again. But let's go back to the monetary policy. The Federal Reserve will not be active in the November meeting, right?
Or October, I would say. No,
they don't meet. You weren't listening.
Oh, sorry, Rich. Sorry. And it's September. So I'm sorry. It's September. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. we missed Steve, right? Steve would have caught up on that.
That's
so right now the markets are forecasting, you know, we'll have 50 basis points cut by the Fed before the election, and then another 25 afterwards. So think about it. We were at 125 of expectations 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Now they're saying, okay, we'll have 50 with the first cut happening maybe June, definitely by July.
But I think people need to understand these are not gospel, and that's why they change. Just so people understand, like that people, these are bets that people are making using Fed fund futures and other instruments like option adjusted swaps, overnight interest rates swaps and option adjusted spreads and all these different sort of weird and wonderful financial products in order to sort of make bets and hedge out positions, whether they be currency or bonds and stuff like that. And what that does is it sort of creates a probability distribution. It doesn't mean that this is exactly what necessarily people think. It's just a way of sort of, it is sort of an amalgam of other people, of all of their views, right? Is that fair?
Rich,
so people understand.
Yeah, why don't you take 40 minutes to explain the option adjusted spreads?
I'm just thinking, when we talk about these cuts being priced in, you know, some people might get the impression that they're gospel, but they're not. They move around and they do, depending on the data, and, you know.
Yeah, correct. And the reason we share this with everyone, it's because everything is directly or heavily indirectly affected by interest rate expectations. So whether it's overnight interest rates or long-term rates or the five-year rate, for example, if you're in the housing world, you know. It's incredibly important, and it doesn't matter if the market's going to be right or wrong at this moment in time. If you go into the bank to get financing for something, or if you're a company, you're looking to issue, say, a $500 million bond, you do a CapEx spend in Saskatchewan, you know, because you get an opportunity to increase productivity. You're priced based on what today's expectations are. We're demonstrating to you right now is that two things. One, you know, we are experiencing a bit of a euphoria right now for equity markets. Not the bond. By the way, the bond market has been mullered over the last 12 days or so. So it's a bit ironic here. You have the bond market be mullered and equities are not. I think we do have something sort of shifting on us coming up. But we're in this sort of euphoria moment that is likely going to change, that's also going to change the whole rate cycle. So I know last week, I mentioned that, hey, if housing markets, you know, fell by 50%, you know, I said the banks would collapse, basically, like that.
That's right.
Yeah, and this is not investment advice, by the way. It sounds very dramatic to use the word collapse. But what I mean by that is that if the housing market dropped by 50%, so 50 or half 100, if you're in the trading world, it means all of a sudden, hey, all those loans that the banks have lent out as mortgages, you know, they're all now underwater. Like there's these enormous losses come from that kind of a system. But again, we are in this expectation now, especially for the Americans, because everything is hinged on a soft landing, you know, a Goldilocks environment. And I suspect that's not going to hold up. Something else is going to go snap here before the election comes along.
But that's the thing. But see, here's where I push back on, you know, like there's a lot of data that's supporting sort of a resurgence, or at least a let's say everything's temporary, but let's say sort of a relatively short term cyclical upturn. You know, and you say, look, if you look at the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index is now above zero and trending higher for the US, China, and Europe. The global GDP tracker, which is lagging a bit, is, you know, above its sort of medium-term range. You got the S&P Global Manufacturing PMI and the services PMIs back above 50 and trending higher. You got your 2024 GDP growth forecasts. The U.S. is now up at 2.2, and been rising. Inflation expectations for the U.S. have also been rising. You know, so, and then you look at commodity prices. You know, if you look at basically everything outside of grains, so there's soft commodities, there's grain and other agricultural commodities, and then there's raw industrial commodities.
Don't forget cocoa.
Yeah, cocoa, that's right, all-time high. So, I mean, and this is why I think a lot of these cuts are getting priced out. And I think it's just important to understand that it's not, yes, I agree with you. There's a lot of complacency in the credit sphere and the credit market. We know spreads are basically super, super low. But it's not unreasonable to say that there's some cyclical upturn here. And to ignore that, I think, would be unfair.
Yeah, I think it's unreasonable to be unreasonable with that view. So we'll see where we go here with it. And again, I keep coming back to, we've had a 3-month period where expectations have changed dramatically.
Yeah.
Right? And it's one thing for, say, expectations for a specific industry to change, you know, over 3 months or something like that. For interest rate policy, inflation expectations, economic growth, all this stuff to change in such a short time frame, that just tells me that risk is not being correctly priced right now. So yeah, again, it's something that really catches our attention, and you know, I tend to get a bit excited about it.
Yeah, so I think that's where we agree, in the sense that, because I mean, the better this goes, in a sense. And the further out these cuts are priced in, the more complacent I think the market gets. And, you know, you have nominal GDP growth in the US and Canada so slowing. And, you know, this idea of this no landing sort of gets back into people's minds. And, you know, yeah, I think the complacency, I think, is getting more and more solidifying more and more. But it's hard. At the same time, you know, you do have some industries that are doing well. Like, you know, we don't talk enough about sort of the data that comes out, but like yesterday was the JOLTS data. And, you know, everybody was sort of harping on the retail part of that outlook, which is continues to fall. So JOLTS is the labor survey. It tells you how many openings and quits and hires and all that stuff for different sectors across the board. And one of the most important sectors in the United States and in Canada is the construction sector. So yes, there's sort of a lot of negativity surrounding retail sales, and because consumption is the largest part of GDP in the US, it's 75% in the US, it's 65% in Canada and Europe. But lo and behold, construction job openings is basically flirting with all-time highs, and they employ an incredible amount of people, and there's huge knock-on effects from the construction sector. And so that's why I think you're getting sort of this push-pull, you know, constantly, which I think is leading to this complacency, Keith. And that's why when the turn comes, I think it's going to be even more fun, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just shift a little bit, because we might have about 5 minutes left here, I think, before we jump. So we have the Bank of Canada out next Wednesday.
Yeah.
Thursday, we have the central bank from the economic fantasy land called Europe. We have them coming out. You know, but again, they've already planted the seed like this week, you know, yesterday, and then again today, you know, they might cut. They're now seeing, you know, the benefits of maybe cutting. So again, we are getting into that stage coming up. But what else is jumping up on your radar besides the central banks? And
well, let's stick to Europe. I think what's really fun about Europe is sort of the bifurcation of North versus South. So so we didn't have the loonie hour during the euro area crisis, Keith, but you would have loved that. So, you know, 10 years ago or so, we had a situation where Germany was the strong, dominant economic model of Europe, and they were telling the rest of Europe how to live, what to do, to run budget deficits or not, to be, you know, to do reform, to change this, to change that. And now we're in a situation where it's the total opposite happens. Due to purely self-inflicted wounds around energy policy, pipelines, etc., we have a situation where actually the southern part of Italy is having a resurgence. And you can't say it any other way. I mean, the banking sector is one of the banking sector in Italy and Spain, one of the best performing subsectors in the world. And you have, look at the composite PMIs for both Italy and Spain are basically ripping. They're back above 50 and heading up. And meanwhile, you have Germany, whose economy, certainly the energy intensive part of the economy, continues to contract, which is, I mean, just a nightmare. You look at the there's different sorts of indicators you can look at, whether it's earnings revisions are negative and falling. The ZEW is an institute of sort of economics and business confidence in Germany. That's falling. Capacity utilization, so how much of your industry are you using or not using? Normally it's about 80 or 90% in Germany. It's falling down to 75, 76 or whatever it is. You know, your industrial production is collapsing. So it's amazing. So you have the total opposite of what we had 10 years ago. So 10 years ago at this time, you had the Germans economy doing really well, cyclically doing well, telling everybody in the South how to behave and what to do, etc. And now the shoe is absolutely on the other foot. And it's just, I think it's, I mean, it's, what is it called? How do you say it? Schadenfreude?
I don't know that word.
You don't know that word? It's a German word for pleasure in another person's pain.
It sounds very German.
Schadenfreude. So that's something I thought, you know, it for people who may not be paying attention to sort of what's going on in Europe, or I think it's definitely something worth keeping an eye on, how that plays out.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting with, you know, with Europe now. Is, you know, say you're the Americans or the Canadians. Let's leave Canada out. We're not highly thought of right now, I think, on the international stage. But say you say, hey, we have to call Europe. You know, who do you call? Do you call the Germans anymore? Is it the French? The Italians?
I don't know.
I don't know the answer, right? I'm not trying to be anything but
I don't know, but the data is very clear. Like, it's amazing when you look at those PMIs. One is doing super well and one is just doing totally badly, and it's the total opposite. Sorry.
Yeah, but I assume it has to do with, you know, obviously their margins must be getting hit pretty hard because the cost of energy is rising. But they are, you know, the Germans are an export machine. So who are they selling to, and who is not buying as much as they have? And is it the Chinese? Is that where, is the Chinese, you know, recession? Is that what's hurting Germany quite a bit? Well,
I mean, the Chinese have just basically, so one thing that's really important so people know is the Chinese are basically now the largest auto manufacturer in the world, and auto exporter in the world. So they're now above Japan and they're above Germany, who used to basically reign supreme. US gave up that title many, many, many years ago. Germany's really just suffering because of terrible, terrible energy policy and sort of the lagging effects of that. So I got to correct you, energy prices are falling, but from a super, super high level that is far higher than where it was 3 years ago. And if I'm not mistaken, sort of the producer price index for energy in Germany is, I think, still twice what it was sort of in 2018, 2019. And you have to understand that these companies like BASF and half a dozen other companies that are escaping me right now in Germany, their whole entire business is translating cheap or relatively cheap energy into products that people want through engineering marvels and the rest of that. And without that sort of input cost being low and relatively stable, those businesses don't survive. And so what they're doing is they're moving the businesses away from Germany, which is a high labor cost and low productivity due to energy,
to places like Poland and Mexico and whatever it is. And as a function of that, you're having a real real issue. Not to mention the housing market is falling. So that's another sort of wrinkle. In 2013 or 14, the Germans were giving shit to the Europeans because they had a housing bubble and now they're paying for it and they had a balance sheet recession. Well, lo and behold, house prices in Italy are rising. That includes for commercial real estate, industrial real estate, and is now back up to its previous peak. I mean, it did take 10 years, mind you. In Spain, they're rising again as a function of having a huge sort of collapse, but nonetheless, they're rising. And in Germany and France, house prices are falling because interest rates are higher. And so it's just really amazing. I mean, everything really is cyclical. You said it earlier before, like we do get swings and roundabouts, and you will have an opportunity, I think, in this market, and whether it's housing or whatever. But it's just, it's delicious. I shouldn't be enjoying it, but this is like classic, like Schadenfreude, and
you do have a little hint of enjoyment coming out of it. I can sense that. Okay, let's wrap up real quick here. A rapid fire question for you.
Sure.
Well, you can think about it, of course, but give us any kind of a market surprise for, say, 12 months out, 6 months out, 18 months. It doesn't have to be, you know, a diffusion index explanation, and be whatever you think. And then we'll just talk for 30 seconds on why. And then maybe then the listeners or viewers can think about it themselves and then appreciate, okay, if this happens, how does that affect everything else in the world?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a rotation, basically. I think the leadership in the market will change. I think when you look at tech industry selling at 8.7 times price to sales, I think in 12 months, people will look back and go, that was crazy. I can't believe people bought companies on 8 times price to sales. Just to give you some context, the rest of the market's selling at, you know, 2.5 or whatever. And I think that there's going to be a real change in leadership, like which sectors or stocks are doing well versus stocks that did really well in the last 12, 24 months, I think will do poorly. And then the stocks that people have hated for a long time, I think will start to do better. That's
a good observation, Rich, because, you know, it happens frequently. You know, I love when you have any market or a segment of the market that is really taking off from everything else. Because, you know, you do get the meme version taking place. That's interesting. Not that exciting. Not that exciting, of course. I think people wanted something a bit different.
Oh.
You don't get a do-over. That's okay. I will, of course, mine's more exciting because I thought of the question. I think we have the opportunity for oil prices to go a lot higher than where we are. You know, you have a lot of this conversation, you know, because of the whole, you know, climate change, green policies, ESG, everything, that, you know, crude is not as important as it used to be. And, you know, maybe $80 is the floor and all that stuff. A lot of the supply dynamics, they are starting to tighten quite a bit. You know, right now we're around $85 for West Texas Intermediate, WTI. You know, maybe we go back down to low 60s. You know, that could happen. But I think the outlier that could really happen here is that, you know, crude oil prices can really settle at 100 and higher without any kind of major event taking place. And then the central banks are then, you know, stumbling again. Because, I mean, inflation is, you know, getting picked up. So that's that's one thing that we're really looked at. We're going to make a lot of money on it, of course. But commodity prices have been bottoming for about 12 months now, and it's
so that's why I wanted to jump in there, because like that's what's also interesting. So people may not know, but usually commodity prices and the dollar are inversely correlated. Again, that's broad strokes here, don't at me, but generally when the dollar goes higher, because commodity prices are priced in dollars, the commodity will go lower. And what we've seen, which sort of supports your view, Keith, is that as the dollar has been, let's say, weak-ish, we're seeing the commodity prices are continuing to rise. And I thought that's something definitely to keep an eye on.
Yeah, because again, like everyone, you know, right now, everyone is, you know, it's focused on the magnificent seven, six, five.
But it's now shrinking. So Apple's, that's what I mean. Fresh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Apple's making fresh lows. Tesla's in trouble a little bit.
And that's what went so while that's happening, you know, commodity prices are firming like all over. And again, we just want to remind everyone, you got to look at this whole picture, everything, markets all over, not just the stock market. In the bond market, look at the whole yield curve and credit spreads, commodities, you know, what are the central banks doing? What's happening on the election cycle and all? It all ties together here. But again, we could, you know, if the economies do roll over and then commodity prices stay high, it's going to create some real awkward moments. Give you an idea here. I know we're last thing. I remember like a loaf of bread used to cost like $2 at the grocery store, maybe $2.25. $7.50 now, Rich.
What's crazy about that is the grain, but grain indexes are down, which is I find interesting. I don't know. I don't really understand that.
No, again, like we're in this wacky world that we need to get sorted out. But I think though, what we'll leave it with there, and you know, hopefully everyone, you know, stayed on here without, you know, Steve. So remember, Rich and I have the Bank of Canada down for no action next week. We pencil Steve in for a 25 basis points cut because I can read his mind a little bit. And any last words, Rich? Is that good for you?
Yeah, I think Steve's a better host than you are.
Yeah, I know. Because he has that like that very likable, brooding...
Yeah,
thing going on. So,
but no, otherwise, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. And
yeah, thank you, everyone. And we'll see everyone next week.